Welcome to the Climate Diplomacy Podcast, a podcast from Adelphi, bringing you the latest insights and debates in international climate diplomacy. We are your hosts, Raquel Monayat and Hannah Kuonut. In this series, you will hear from leading experts offering their take on what needs to be done to promote climate foreign policy and provide you with the context you need to understand climate diplomacy today. For more information, please visit climate-diplomacy.org or follow us on Twitter under Climate Diplo.
In this episode, we discuss climate fragility risks in Libya together with Matthew Brubacher. Matthew has been working in conflict-affected countries for the past 25 years. Until the end of last year, Matthew was the economic advisor to the UN political mission in Libya, where he supported efforts to incentivize the energy transition. He has since resigned from the UN to work full-time on climate change and is now providing support on this issue to agencies, including the Special Envoy for the Horn of Africa and the UN Coordinator for Development in the Sahel. Before we start, we would like to apologize for any small audio disruptions due to remote recording. Hi, Matthew. We are glad to welcome you to the Climate Diplomacy Podcast.
Yeah, good afternoon, both of you. It's nice to be here.
We always like to start by giving our listeners some background on the country or region we will address. I think this is particularly important in the case of Libya, which is usually not a country we hear about every day. Mm-hmm. But at this time, and especially today, since yesterday with the appointment of the new prime minister, it has been all over the news. So could you give us some insights on the recent developments and also bring in the relevant socioeconomic, geographical and political context at play in Libya?
Yeah, well, thanks for that. Libya is never a dull place. I've been working on it now for 6 or 7 years, and there's always something happening. So, of course, yesterday, you had some very important events happening. You had an assassination attempt against the current prime minister, Dbeibah. And you had what is basically a return of the old guard to Libya, which is a very powerful vanguard, which is trying to displace the current government. And that was endorsed by the House of Representatives, which is the parliament that exists in Libya. And so basically now you have a possibility that you'll have again two competing governments in Libya. We had two competing governments before, after the civil war in 2014, but now we might again have two competing governments. And that really fragments the institutions a lot. And so Libya is really at a critical juncture right now. So, but if you allow me, I'd like to go back and just give a little bit of context, because if you just jump in on Libya, sometimes it can be a little bit confusing. So Libya, it's a very big country. Territorially, it's big. But you know that the population is really, really small. It's only like 6 million people. And historically, it's been small because there's just no water in the country. There's no rivers. Precipitation is very small. There's only 2% of the land is arable. The land just doesn't sustain a big population. And the other thing people associate with Libya a lot is oil. Of course, you think it's almost synonymous, Libya oil, Libya gas. That's extremely important for Libya. They discovered oil in the 1950s. And Libya has the biggest reserves in Africa. And because of the embargo, actually, during the Gaddafi period, much of that reserves, both oil and gas, are undiscovered. So we actually don't even know how much oil Libya has, but it has a lot of oil. And the oil it has is actually very good quality. It's a high quality oil, it's low sulfur content. So it has this kind of a sweet crude, and especially at a very high price on the international markets. And it's also very strategic because it's near Europe, it's on the Mediterranean. So it's very easy to transport the fuel. So it has a very low operational cost, which makes it also very, very competitive. This discovery of oil had a huge impact on the development of the country and also the psyche of the population. If you don't understand this component of it, it's really hard to understand the Libyan society. Because it's so rich in oil, Libya really became a rentier state. It focused exclusively on this commodity. And it reaped huge rewards financially. And that allowed it to invest in huge infrastructure projects like the man-made river. It's universalized electricity as a huge, centralized electricity grid. There's no income tax. There's no VAT. I mean, the tax base for Libya is like 2-3% of its revenue. So it's really incredibly small. But, you know, there are some bad things that go along with that, as you probably can imagine. The one really, really bad thing, of course, is that it's dependent exclusively on international commodity. So when prices fluctuate, of course, its revenue fluctuates wildly because 87% is based on oil. The other thing that people don't see very much or don't understand very much of is that the social contract that the Libyans have with the state is very different than other countries. Because they don't pay income tax, their contract with the state is different. So there's a huge sense of entitlement among the Libyan population that we don't pay income tax, we don't pay for water, we don't pay for electricity. And these things are taken for granted. And that's why also Libya is quite fragmented. It's very divided. There's a lot of factionalism because there's very little social contract to bind them together. And so that has a very negative consequence. The other really negative bug in Libya is that everything relies on the public sector. The government employs half the population, basically. Since the last two governments unified and they unified their payroll, the payroll went up to about 2.8 million people on the payroll. It's 67% of the budget goes to salaries. And so that's half the living population is on the government payroll. It creates a huge, very burden for the government because it leaves very little revenue left for development spending. And it also leaves very little space for the private sector. So the private sector is probably like 4 or 5% of GDP. And that's partly a legacy of this, but also partly a legacy that Gaddafi just didn't trust the private sector. So it was always very small. But because you have these big state institutions, these big state-owned enterprises, it crowds out private enterprise. They can't compete. When you get all these subsidies, when you get indirect upstream, downstream subsidies, the private sector, and this is particularly relevant, I'll talk about it later, about the renewable sector. The private sector just can't get into the renewable market because the state-owned enterprise, GECO, utility company, just crowds them out. They can't compete because the price of electricity is so low. It's the lowest in Africa. How do you then charge people more for electricity that they just take for granted? It crowds out that innovation. It crowds out efficiency. So that's one of the things that's holding back the energy transition in Libya. The other thing, just by way of background, politically in Libya, basically it was under dictatorship under Gaddafi. Everybody knows that period of time. Between 2011 and 2014, so from the spring to 2014, it was really like a honeymoon period for Libya. They put in place a new constitution. They had a fair national election. A new government was formed, unified government. And things were going well. Prices of oil were really high. And there was a real sense of euphoria. But that didn't last. And for a lot of reasons, the government, in large part of the country, kind of broke apart and they went into a civil war. And that civil war divided them, largely between the East and the West, but it's more complicated than that. And basically, you had two different governments. So there's a competition for legitimacy. Who's the legitimate government? Who gets the revenue? Who gets control over which resources? And so you had these institutions suddenly being captured by different factions who wanted the rents. They wanted the central bank. Oh, I get the rent from this. I want the Libyan Investment Authority. I get the rent from that. I want the National Oil Corporation. Oh, I get the rent from that. So you had this sort of capturing of the state institutions. And that, of course, impeded cooperation, obviously, interministerial cooperation. But it also impeded the functioning of those state institutions, which became incredibly weak. And so what the UN did, and I was a part of that process, we basically brokered two different interim arrangements. The Skhirat Agreement in 2015, 2016 in Morocco ushered in a new unified government called the Government of National Accord. We got them in power for a little while. Things were going okay. And we were trying to push them into elections. We were trying to create the conditions for national elections because that's what was really required to kind of restore the country, restore legitimacy. But unfortunately, we didn't get there. And then another war happened after the LNA attacked Tripoli. And so then we went into another civil war. And that civil war was a little bit different than the other one because there was so much international involvement. The Turks came in, UAE came in, Egypt came in. So you had a lot of mercenaries. You had a lot more internationalization of the armed conflict. Like the SRSG, Stephanie always says, mercenaries, they make bad house guests. Once they come in, they just don't leave. It kind of undermined Libyan sovereignty, and they're still dealing with that until today. And basically, to get out of that, we made another interim arrangement, and we created the Government of National Unity, which is now headed by Prime Minister Dibeba. And he was supposed to only stay for a couple months and then go for elections. But like it always happens, everybody that comes into power wants to stay in power. And now we're in a situation where things are getting difficult, legitimacy is being challenged. Once that legitimacy is challenged, then you have competition coming in. And now you have the former Minister of Interior, Bashagha, who's been endorsed by the HOR, Aguila, and actually has the support of General Haftar, who's the commander of the Libyan National Army, formerly in the East. And so now they're coming in and they're going to try to displace Dibeba. And so again, as of yesterday, you'll probably have two competing governments coming in. And so really, Libya is at a precipice again. What's Dibeba going to do? Is he going to be able to hold out? Is Bashagha strong enough to push him out? And it's interesting, again, because they both come from the same town, Misrata. They're like neighbors. They probably went to the same school. But anyways, it's a very unique situation.
Thanks a lot for this fairly comprehensive overview, Matthew. It's actually quite complex indeed and will likely also continue changing in the near future, perhaps even in the coming weeks. Let's see. But that was already very useful also for our listeners to understand what is going on in Libya. As my colleague said, we don't hear much about it. And if we do, it doesn't come with a background explanation. So that's certainly very, very useful. And just thinking from our perspective on the climate and sustainability and environmental perspectives, the fact that Libya remains, as of today, it remains a fragile state, and it's also experiencing frequent changes in the management of institutions such as that are taking place right now. This has, of course, a huge impact on the country's ability to transition to a low-carbon development model, which is probably something that is not even a top priority for Libya, as it is for so many other countries. So we'll certainly also get into that. But before we do dive in, maybe you could just walk us through just the specific ways in which climate change manifests or is manifesting right now in Libya.
Climate change is always displaced by other priorities in Libya, especially when you have these events like assassination attempts and things like that. But I'd just like to explain the impact of climate change in the way that I discovered it. For me, it was transformative. It actually kind of reoriented my whole career. And basically, I discovered the impact of climate change back in 2016. When the civil war happened, the whole UN scattered. And then they all started drifting back to the country and to Tunisia and other places. And we started to reassess the situation. A lot of people had left. A lot of new people came, including myself. And so to figure out the situation, we did what we call a joint country assessment, where the whole UN gets together, they assess the country, and then it feeds into the strategic framework, which is basically our how we go about helping that country. And when we do the joint country assessments now, since the SDGs were created, there's always a chapter on climate change. And since nobody wanted to write it, I volunteered to write it with a colleague from the World Bank. And when we wrote that chapter, I discovered basically what was happening, what was going to happen in Libya. And the impacts were so bad, I didn't really believe it at first. Actually, I didn't believe it. Because the impacts are what? That Libya's in the Mediterranean. The Mediterranean's a hot zone for climate change because the Mediterranean is such a shallow sea and it's surrounded by large land masses. And then you have this strange interaction between the Sahel weather patterns and the Mediterranean, which is going to reduce precipitation by quite a bit. And in fact, I mean, the temperature is going up so fast in Libya, it's already at 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial levels. And then because the Mediterranean, again, is shallow, it's heating up faster, the sea level is rising faster. Normally, it's about 2 millimeters a year. And in the Mediterranean, it's like 6 millimeters a year. So it's going up faster and faster. And of course, most Libyans live on the coast. So you have Benghazi, Tripoli, Zawara. You have all these cities are right on the coast. So when you have the sea level rising up, it's really bad. It's going to take out parts of the cities, you know. And then, of course, you have the salinization of the groundwater, which is usually a big problem when the sea level rises. Unfortunately, fortunately for Libya, it doesn't really matter because by the 1980s, they had already pumped out so much water with their agricultural projects that they had already allowed seawater to enter the coastal aquifer. So it was already salty. But in any regards, the sea level is not going to make it any easier. And, you know, the impact was so bad, I started calling that chapter the Armageddon chapter. Depending on what your time perspective is, the scenarios are really Armageddon-like. And so what was interesting in that process was I started going around at the meetings and saying, did you read the Armageddon chapter? And then we went to the government for the validation. Did you read the Armageddon chapter? And some people looked over it, some people read it and things like this, but nobody had any recommendations as what to do about it. And that really interested me. I was like, wow, these are really smart people. These are the heads of the government. These are the heads of the United Nations. And nobody has anything to say about it or do about it. And I was like, well, that is just fascinating. I asked that question, like, why is that? I'm still asking it today, 6 years on or whatever. And basically, I can only come up with three explanations for this strange phenomena. And the first one is, of course, the one that everybody knows is the discounting of the threat because it's so far away, it's so vague, it's so big that it's not defined enough to really appreciate it as an imminent threat. So you don't react to it, even though the impacts are big and the probability of it is very high. So you have the discounting aspect. And then the other one, which I get a lot of, it's not my responsibility. Well, if that's the perspective, then we're really lost because it's such a multidisciplinary issue that everybody really has to get on board to have any impact. So that, I think that's the second reason. But the third reason, and I think the one that's encountered the most, and I think most of my colleagues can sympathize with this the most, is what I call the tyranny of the immediate. Because you're a political mission in a fragile state, things are moving all the time. You're trying to get a roadmap going to the next election or the next benchmark to an election. And so you have all these things happening that have really high priority. And so you can't focus on these long-term issues that require a lot of investment and a lot of integration planning and things like that. So that tyranny of the immediate is always distracting everybody. Even the current government, GNU, you know, they went to Glasgow. They realized how far behind Libya was. You could see that they were really disappointed because, you know, Libya is the only country in the world that hasn't done a national determined contribution. They have not done any carbon inventory. Everybody else has done it. I mean, Somalia did it, DRC did it, Syria did it. Yemen's done three. Libya hasn't done one. They haven't even communicated anything. So, you know, the prime minister team comes back and said, we're going to do something about climate change. I'm going to form a committee. We're going to get this thing going. By the next week, they'd moved on to something else. It's a tyranny of the immediate. It just moves. That was the issue last week. Now we're focused on something else. The ball's moved down the field. Everybody's focused on the ball. You can't play two balls at the same time. So that's really what my discovery about it was.
That's quite interesting to hear how actually far behind Libya is in the international community in terms of prioritizing climate change. I mean, you have all levels of commitment, but I wouldn't have thought that far. But it makes sense with an economy that isn't diversified. Given the dimensions of the climate issues, like you just mentioned, the Armageddon chapter.
Armageddon.
My next question might be redundant, but just because we are also here to talk about the climate risks, the security risks, we wanted, of course, to know, how are these climate change related impacts affecting security on the ground?
It's happening in a lot of different ways. I mean, the first thing I'd like to say about that, though, is that Libya would be in trouble with or without climate change. Climate change is just going to make it a lot more difficult because basically the whole country relies on two resources. It's oil and gas and fossil water. This is how they survive. And both of them are fossil. They're finite resources. They're using them very, very, very quickly. So eventually they're going to run out and water is going to be the first one that runs out. But they're very much interlinked, and I'll explain a little bit about that. The way it manifests itself is like this. So basically on the electricity sector, you have to take sector by sector and then bring them together later. Libya is 100% electrified. It's the first country in Africa to have done so. And it has a fantastic grid. It's a big country, but everything is integrated. It's an integrated grid. And they have like 16 power stations pumping it out. They use oil and gas. There's no renewable energy in Libya. It doesn't exist. So everybody just turns on the lights and it goes on well until the last couple of years, because the price of electricity hasn't gone up since, I think the last time it went up was 1997. So the price of electricity is very, very low. After the revolution, the consumption of electricity doubled in 2013. Why? Maybe a lot more people were buying fridges. No, it wasn't because of this. Because the GECO stopped collecting the tariffs from people. So even though the price was low, they weren't even collecting that. And when you don't pay for something, you use more of something. And so the electricity consumption, the demand side went up immensely. And so while demand is going up, revenue to GECO, the utility company, was going down. So even though they were subsidized, even though they don't pay for the fuel, they had operating costs, but they weren't able to cover those operating costs anymore. And so there's a slow breakdown of the maintenance of all these power stations and a breakdown of the transmission sector. So you basically had these old factories, these turbines that were just breaking down all the time, and they were fixing it, putting bandages on it and things like that. But eventually by 2017, there were total grid shutdowns because there's two peaks, summertime, wintertime peaks. Once you get to a deficit of like 50%, you can't cover 50%, the grid shuts down. And what was interesting also about that, GECOs, they're trying to do load shedding where you shut off certain parts of the country because you don't have enough electricity. And what was so interesting, they would shut down, you know, Beni Waleed or Zawiya or whatever. And each of these cities are controlled by militias that are local and they're always competing for legitimacy and popularity. They actually figured out how to disable the emergency breakers for the city. In a centralized grid, you have breakers because you don't want to overload the system. You overload the system, you explode the turbines. So these militias were disabling the breakers because they wanted to show, or they're putting a gun to the guy's head, telling him to keep it on. What happened was basically the system couldn't regulate itself and it would just shut down. The whole country would just shut down. And so what happened when that happened, obviously, people got really angry because it also impedes water distribution. Like you can't pump the water up. You can get it sometimes coming down from the south where it comes from, but you can't pump it up. And so there was riots. People would be burning cars and the legitimacy of the government was threatened. There was times when the prime minister's office was surrounded by militias and mobs and things like that. And then you also had this, what we call the cannibalization of the electricity sector. When you don't have electricity, people go out and they start taking the copper out of the wires and they start just cannibalizing the whole thing. So you start this descending cycle. That's when we got together with the World Bank and with USAID and UNEP and UNDP. Eventually we fixed the situation because we sat down with the GCOAL company and they were really an end because their lives were being threatened. And so then we put in place this grid stabilization program, but that was really problematic.
So you're talking about all these issues with energy. You also mentioned agriculture and the extensive use of water for that and the use of fossil water and how much it is at the brink of coming to its exhaustion. So this looks to me as a classic case of water, energy, food nexus. So of course, these sectors, they're always somehow tied to each other, of course, but there are some contexts where they seem to be more strongly connected on a more direct and fundamental level, which does seem to be the case here. And if it is, this force implies that solutions to these resources issues in Libya should look at these three dimensions in tandem. So like the so-called holistic solutions that we hear a lot in the climate community. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, electricity and water are symbiotic. You can't really have one without the other. Electricity needs the cooling and water needs electricity to do the pumping. But in Libya, again, it's unique because you have basically two big problems with water. Very immediate problem and you have a medium-term problem. The very immediate problem is that because there was a lack of development spending and a lack of interministerial cooperation, the desalination plants basically have been breaking down. They hardly function anymore. And the wastewater recycling also doesn't happen anymore. So it all gets pumped into the ocean or into the desert. So the only thing they have left is the fossil water that comes from the man-made river project. Basically, how it works, you have two big water well fields, each of them having a couple hundred wells. And each of those wells is about 500 meters deep. Those wells bring up the aquifer water, and then it goes into one big tube, which is about the size of your room. And it basically goes by gravity all the way to the coast, and that's where it's consumed. And that requires a large amount of electricity. Each field requires about 60 megawatts of electricity at any one time. So when you don't have electricity, you don't have any water. When those pumps stop because of the pressure, it takes a really long time to create an equilibrium in terms of the pressure within the pumps to actually get that thing moving again. So every time you stop it, it takes a long time to get going and you can really damage the equipment and it's custom built equipment. So that's a big problem. That's why GCOAL always gives preference to the man-made river for electricity. Now that creates another problem because in the southeast near Egypt, that water goes to the local communities, the people that live in the desert there. In the southwest, however, the man-made river doesn't give water to the communities. They have their own wells and their own distribution networks. So when they see that the man-made river has electricity and they don't have electricity, they get angry because they don't have water. They don't have much reserves either. After 2 or 3 days, they just don't have any water anymore. That makes people really, really, really angry. And also they realize that there's only a certain amount of water left. And so they resent the fact that this water is being pumped up to go to Tripoli to have people wash their cars. That's what they always say. And so what they do, there's different tribes down there, the Mugerha, the Sauna, and those guys. And there's kind of a permissive environment where they can destroy man-made river infrastructure. So a lot of wells have been destroyed. About 160 wells, I think, have been destroyed now. It's about 40% of the capacity of the man-made river. That is a big, big problem. The head of the MMR, he always says to me, he goes, you know, they destroy a well to get the copper and they get, you know, like $1,000. And it cost me $1 million to repair it. You know, it's just such a huge thing. So you have that problem. And then you also have the problem that there's a lot of valves that you can shut down along the pipeline. And so people shut the water down if they're not happy with something. So it could be electricity, but it could also be, I want my brother out of jail in Tripoli, because he's not supposed to be in jail. There's a guy, he did it twice. Another guy did it once. So they shut the whole water down and they basically hold the whole cities for ransom until their brother's released from prison. And so I was often involved in negotiations with these guys. And basically, I hate conceding to blackmail, which is what it is. But in these situations, you have to concede to blackmail because the consequences are just so high. I remember one time they had shut down water for like 10 days. And Tripoli ran out of water and we were getting together with the whole UN and we were like, how do we get these people water? And we were actually costing it out what it would take to get a desalination ship off the coast of Tripoli from Turkey. And the cost of a cubic meter of water, I think, was like $50 or $60, even without distribution costs. It was incredibly outrageously expensive. So there's really no backup. They have no backup plan. You can get the salty water, which makes your hair funny colors. You can do that, but really there's no fresh water except for the fossil. And this animosity between the Southwestern groups and the man-made river has been a real problem. It's kind of like a mini water war.
Thanks so much, Matthew, for giving us a real deep dive into this topic. Personally, I find it really interesting to hear more how it plays out onto so many different levels and it's then connected within society and people, obviously, and feeds into grievances that exist due to other reasons. Yeah, really interesting example. Now, you already mentioned some of the institutional challenges tied to the sustainable development of Libya's resources. Let's take a closer look at these ones. Which obstacles in its political or institutional context would you say need to be removed first in order to get Libya's low carbon development off the ground?
In Libya, there's no shortage of obstacles. It's really hard to get things done. Even with people with good intention, it's hard to get things done because of the way the institution is set up. And that's why when you're looking at obstacles, you really have to look at the structural, the financial, and the political. The structural basically is inherited from the Gaddafi regime, where he basically created government ministries and authorities that were separated from each other, that didn't communicate with each other, that only communicated with the center. So it's a highly centralized government. And when that center collapsed, these satellite ministries didn't know what to do. They couldn't communicate with each other. They didn't know how to cooperate with each other. And that's still a big problem until today, is how do you get the National Oil Corporation to cooperate with the GCOL? How do you get GCOL to cooperate with the MMR? How do you get the MMR to cooperate with the company for wastewater treatment? All these things are extremely complicated. Then how do you get the money to go through to actually fix things? So that structural aspect, I think, is really important. You know, until today, Libya doesn't have a minister of energy. They have a minister of oil. They have a head of the electric company. They have a head of the water company. But there's nobody that brings them together. I've organized meetings between them and I had to introduce them to each other. I was like, this is electricity company. This is water company. You guys should be friends. Talk to each other. That's a real structural problem. The other one is financial. And it's what I said before. Everything is subsidized. Everybody is on the payroll. There's very little accountability. So there's a lot of debt in Libya, which is hidden in funny places. But there's not much money coming into the states because they don't collect a lot of the tariffs. The head of the water company goes, it costs me 22 cents for a cubic meter of fossil water, but I charge 1 cent, but then I don't even collect that 1 cent. So you have these debt streams that keep coming up. And that financial aspect, it does a lot of things. First of all, it incentivizes overconsumption. People use too much. They don't pay for it. They use too much. And then it stops investment and maintenance for the infrastructure that you have. And then it crowds out innovation. How do you innovate? How do you bring in the private sector when the cost of the service is so low? So that's the financial aspect. And then there's the political aspect. And there's really two angles to the political aspect. The one is what you see today. We have two governments coming in. We have a competition for legitimacy. When you have competition for legitimacy, people don't think about raising the price of electricity or raising the price of water. That's not politically expedient. So instead, they gravitate towards patronage. And you saw that a lot in the last government. They give more entitlements. They give more benefits. They lower the price more. They're trying to get more support. And so instead of addressing the root causes of the problems, they're just pouring money in after bad. It creates this cycle that doesn't address the problems. And then when you get to places where the whole thing starts breaking down, those are the main challenges.
As in every risk brief from the Climate Security Expert Network, you also identified entry points for addressing the country's climate fragility risks. These are the need for, first, subsidiary reform, second, for incentivizing the energy transition, third, for reducing flaring and fugitive gas emissions, fourth, for rationalizing water use in the agricultural sector, and fifth, for international support to mitigate climate impacts. You already touched upon some of them, but could you perhaps dive into a bit more detail?
Yeah, those are the basket of interventions that you need. I'd like to just preface it by saying, when you're working in a country in Libya, and when you have such an amalgamation of issues that are all interrelated, you have to move on all of them at the same time. You can't just do water, you can't do just electricity, you can't do agriculture. And it's important to do it all at the same time, not just because they're all integrated, but because, especially in these fragile states, you'll come up and you'll hit a roadblock on energy. You know, say there's a change in the leadership. He doesn't want to cooperate. He wants to go in another direction. So the whole program is blocked. And then it unblocks on the water side. So you can make advances on the water side or on the agriculture side until this one unblocks itself. So it's important to work on all of them. And it's important to always be working on all of them at the same time, because you have to always capitalize on the opportunities whenever they present themselves. The other lesson I have from working on this is that you have to capitalize on the co-benefits. In Libya, nobody really cares about climate change, yeah? It's not an issue. Among the youth, it is, increasingly so. But among the older population, it's not an issue. If you want to be effective, you have to look at the co-benefits. You have to say, look, what you're paying for the production of electricity through oil is infinitely more expensive than it would be through renewables. Or your legitimacy as a government is severely under threat because you're not allowed to provide reliable electricity. Let us help you repair your turbines, make them more efficient. So let us help you lower the demand side through this and this effort, and we'll help build your legitimacy that way. So you always have to go through the co-benefit. You can't go through the climate angle because most of the times it doesn't resonate with the audience and with your partnerships. On subsidy reform, subsidies are really hard to get rid of. I think everybody knows that. You saw what happened in France when they tried to do it. But conflict presents unique opportunities for reform, especially on subsidies, for two reasons. Not so much in the case of Libya, but in other countries. When you have conflict, governments have problems with foreign exchange. They have problems with revenue. They can't afford it. So Syria, Iraq, Yemen, they can't pay for subsidies anymore. So that gives them a big incentive, a necessity, really, to reduce, which is good. The other thing with subsidies during conflict is that the market gets really distorted. Prices get super distorted because of supply chains, because of the whole security. So prices on the ground, even though they're subsidized, they fluctuate wildly. They can get really expensive. So for instance, in Sudan, South Sudan, they were subsidizing it. And then the war hit and then it got really expensive. And then basically the government got rid of subsidies. Nobody even knew it. And the same thing happened in Libya. So I think it was 2017, the Minister of Economy scrapped subsidies on lubricants and kerosene for jet fuel. He did it just like this with a stroke of the pen, and nobody even realized it because the prices were so distorted. Everybody thought the price is just going up because there's a war and stuff like that. I call it subsidy reform by subterfuge because it goes against the IMF best practices, educate people, divert it to social security and stuff like that. This is just realpolitik, subsidy reform by subterfuge. For reducing flaring and gas emissions, I think this is a really big thing, including for Europe. Libya has a real big flaring footprint. They flare a lot. They vent a lot of methane. That's one of the biggest footprints they have, is exactly this. And they wouldn't need to do that. You could, through investment, reduce that, and you could use it for fuel, for electricity, and so forth. There's a huge amount of potential there. And actually, there's a huge interest for Europe to do that as well, because Europe is the biggest consumer of Libyan oil and Libyan natural gas. I mean, you have the Green Line going under the Mediterranean to Italy, controlled by Eni. So if Europe really wants to become green, they also have to look at the upstream footprint that they have. And there are regulations in Europe on that, but they just don't implement them. I think there's a lot of possibility there, a lot of possibility for cooperation. The EU, they need Libyan energy. They have big problems on the eastern side. And they should really help Libya be more efficient and cleaner in the production of their fossil fuels, because they're the consumer of it. When it comes to agriculture, agriculture is still really big in Libya, even though it's only 1 to 2% of GDP. It still employs about 25% of the population in the south. And it's done in a very irrational way. They still do open irrigation for most of the time. It's in the desert. A desert's not supposed to grow wheat. You're supposed to grow dates. You're not supposed to grow massive fields of grain. But they do that. And that's not a good way to produce food. They should be importing that food because it's virtual water. They have a water problem. Their aquifer, especially the southwest aquifer, the Muzuk one, is very small. So that's going to run out in like 10 to 20 years. And like I said, there's no backup. So you should try to conserve your water as long as you can, because your state relies on it. So we have some projects now with FAO and others to try to look at, you know, rationalizing the agriculture water use. But agriculture, they consume by far the most water. And then the last one, we need to get Libya to do a carbon inventory to communicate with the UNFCCC. It's time for them to do an NDC. It's time for them to do a carbon inventory and join the international community to move forward.
Absolutely. I feel like we're almost touching on all the important subjects here. I just wanted to focus on one aspect that you've mentioned already a few times, on economic diversification for Libya. And I'd like to mention a quote from your risk brief. With nearly all its foreign currency and 85% of its public revenue deriving solely from hydrocarbon exports, Libya is an archetypal rentier state. Now, you've mentioned this in a few parts of while you explain in the background, and also the kind of issues that Libya has with climate and politics and everything basically that is connected. So here at Adelphi, we also have a team that works on the geopolitics of decarbonization and issues such as stranded assets. It's a very interesting topic for us. We even had a few episodes about it here in the Climate Diplomacy podcast. And it made me think about this because with Libya exporting much of its oil and gas production to the EU, and for it being such a one-sided economy, what would the diversification in Libya mean to Europe, and particularly in light of the current issues that are going on in Eastern Europe?
It's a very important question. It's a discussion I've been trying to move forward in Libya for some time. I can tell you from experience, if you want to kill a conversation or spoil the atmosphere in a room, just bring up the issue of peak oil. It'll kill the room instantly. Nobody wants to talk about it because the oil is everything in Libya. It's everything. And it's assumed that it's going to just continue this way. So while everybody's looking at diversifying, drawing down, while the IEA is saying don't invest in new oil because by 2030, the price could go down by 75%. Libya is trying to double down. They're saying the prices are up. We got to spend more on investment. We got to exploit more. We got to pump more.
A little bit out of tune.
They're going the opposite direction. But that's just the short-term vision, the short-term interest of the politicians these days. If they were to go the other way, if they wanted to go the other way, and they need to go the other way because the timeline to do so is so long. I mean, they have to start doing this now or they'll get into a situation where they're going to be in very, very bad shape. They need to do a lot of things. First of all, they need to rationalize the way they spend their money. They can't continue this way with 67% going to salaries and 17% to subsidies. And most of their subsidies is just fuel smuggling anyway. So, I mean, they have to really fix the way they do their government, spend their money. They have to increase the price on fuel. They have to increase the tariff on water and electricity. They have to make it more sustainable. They have to stop incentivizing overconsumption, make their money last longer, make it more efficient. And then in doing so, that will create the conditions for more private sector, more innovation. It'll grow the business sector a lot if you start making it more competitive. And that's what they need to do to start growing, to start diversifying their economy. The private sector needs to be allowed space and opportunity to grow. They also need to invest more in development. You know, development spending in Libya, which goes to building new roads and building new desalination plants and so forth, it was zero between 2014 and 2016, but then it only went up to like 5-7%, you know. They need to start investing in their future. They need to build new schools. The illiteracy rate is going up in Libya. It's terrible. They need to start building the next generation. Otherwise, they're going to be in really bad shape. And they also need to improve the integrity of their sovereign wealth, like Norway or the Saudis and things. They have sovereign wealth funds who are investing the oil revenue for the rainy day. And Gaddafi was also, he did that. He started the Libyan Wealth Fund in 2008. That wealth fund is $65 billion. But they haven't done an audit ever of that Libyan investment, but they don't even know where their money is. So they need to get that in shape, still under sanctions by the UN Security Council. And I think once they get that in shape, those sanctions will be lifted and they can start reinvesting and they can start diversifying their economy that way through the wealth that they already have.
Thanks. And I think we can say with a fair amount of certainty that eventually diversification will happen in Libya. But what would you think? Do you think that they will eventually cave and join in the global energy transition? Or do you think that peak oil will happen first?
Well, I think peak oil might have already happened, but I think it's going to be really hard for them. I think it's going to be hard for them going forward. They have a small window of opportunity. 10 years, I call it a small window. A small window of opportunity to turn things around, to start going a different direction. And if they don't start going a different direction soon, they're going to run out of time to do so. But it really requires there to be a new government that has legitimacy, that has vision, that has capacity to really get this government working and modernizing itself and moving it forward. And if they don't do that, they're going to be in trouble. So either they get with the energy transition or they're going to be swept away by it. It's really as simple as that.
Thanks a lot. To conclude, let's talk about building back better. Libyan emissions reduced dramatically during its reoccurring civil wars, particularly in 2014 when there was an extended blockade of oil production. How do you think the decrease in emissions could be extended while allowing the economy to recover and the country to rebuild? And are there lessons from the Building Back Better efforts which could be applied to the Libyan context? Also, in your opinion, what are the key obstacles but also opportunities for building back better in Libya?
Thanks for that question. You know, I've been working in conflicts for a long time. So when I started getting into climate change, all the discussion was on how climate change contributes to conflicts or perpetuates conflicts and so forth, which is an interesting conversation. But I wanted to turn that question around. Conflict impacts mitigation and adaptation opportunities. And I think if you look at it from that perspective, things become a lot more constructive. to tell you the truth. When there is conflict, and it's intense conflict, carbon emissions do go down. That's just a fact. It went down half in Libya in 2014. It went down in Yemen. It went down in Syria. Iraq, it didn't go down so much because most of the oil production was in the south. It's a bit of an outlier. But people are really ready to talk about Build Back Better with COVID, which reduced global emissions by 17% in May 2020, but now it's bounced back over what it was. In conflicts, when it goes down 50%, nobody talks about Build Back Better, at least related to climate change. It's kind of strange. I find it strange. And every time I bring the issue up, people are like, well, conflict's not good for mitigation. Conflict, you can't say that. Well, yeah, I mean, you can't say that if you just focus on the death count. People die in conflicts. But, you know, there's a lot of other things happening at the same time. Conflict is a dynamic situation. It's not the same everywhere, even within a country. So you can't just be looking at the body count. You have to be looking at what's happening with these institutions. And you have to be looking where opportunities can be exploited to try to set that country on a low carbon recovery pathway. Because once they recover, they're going to go back to business as usual. It's when they're in this flux, this fluid situation, where you have the most opportunity to redirect that country and redirect their modes of production towards a low carbon recovery pathway. And if people don't recognize that, they obviously haven't worked in conflict situations because there's just so much more opportunity. There's more opportunity for technical advice. The countries are much more open to receiving advice from third parties as to what to do. There's other pressures on them, other incentives. Often when they're in conflict, subsidy reform isn't going to increase the conflict anymore anyways because it's already so partisan to begin with. Some of it's a little bit hard. It's tough. It's realpolitik, a little bit brut. But climate change is going to make conflict. It is going to make it worse. So if that's what's going to happen, people better be ready to start working within conflict situations.
Okay, thanks so much, Matthew. I'll do my very best to summarize what we just discussed, even though it's so comprehensive. So today, we briefly heard about the challenges the country is facing and how Libya is at a critical juncture. You gave us a good impression about the society and economy of the country, highlighting the weakened social contract and big administration, leaving little space for development spending and the private sector. We also briefly touched upon the complicated political history of the country and you emphasized the legitimacy of a government is key and the current situation being a threat to the long-term stability of the country. For you, looking at the impact of climate change was transformative and an eye-opener. You identified two risks in particular that pose existential threats to the country, namely first, the economic impact of reaching peak oil, and second, the risk of exhausting freshwater resources. In light of these risks, you identified different dynamics that threaten long-term peace and stability in Libya. You also highlighted that Libya is not short of obstacles standing in the way of overcoming these challenges and explained a few of them. This includes first the administrative dimension and challenges in cooperating between different ministries and organizations, second, the financial obstacle and debt streams in the country, and third, the political aspects with the competition for legitimacy and the creation of a vicious cycle of patronage. To overcome these challenges, it is important to always work on all entry points we talked about in parallel. To be effectively looking at key benefits is essential. He also mentioned Europe's responsibility as a consumer of energy and put this into the context of the geopolitics of decarbonization. To conclude, you called on Libya to do a carbon inventory and for the country to join the international community in moving forward. Libya faces a small window to turn things around. This requires a new government with legitimacy and capacity. All right. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Have a great day. Weekend.
You too.
Bye.
Thanks.